Blog Talk Radio.
Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac, the host of Breakthrough Thinking. And if it's the first Monday of each month from 3 to 4, it is Practical Business Solutions starring Jim Hyten. Jim, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
This is great. Another episode of Practical Business Solutions. And this is going to be a really good one. They're always good. This is really something I'm looking forward to being part of because you have a very special guest from your own law firm, Blake Whiteman. Blake, nice seeing you again. You've been on our show before.
It's good to see you again, too. I'm happy I'm back.
This is very, very cool. And, of course, you're both from Reitenauer, Hyten & Lewis. Great, great law firm. No doubt about that in Phoenix, Arizona. So this is sort of a hot topic right now, it seems like. The Castle Doctrine, well, really self-defense and stand your ground. We're going to talk a bit about that because I think people really don't understand the ramifications.
Yeah, well, let me kind of introduce Blake a little bit.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I found when I was watching, you know, the TV shows and the radio, listening to the radio shows about all these different things about self-defense, stand your ground, Castle Doctrine, and the Trayvon Martin case, I found myself thinking, well, this doesn't sound right. I mean, I'm getting all kinds of mixed messages, and pretty soon you hear that two people describe the same doctrine completely differently. And so I thought, I'm partners with a guy that's right down the hallway, who's one of my favorite partners in the whole firm, that does this for a living. He does a lot of different things. He's a great litigation partner. He does a lot of commercial litigation, does some domestic relations, but he also does criminal defense work. And I thought, here's a guy that has to really deal with prosecutors who are realistically trying to put clients in jail. And he has to deal with these on a real-time basis, I thought, who better to describe this than a guy that deals with actual defense issues? So that's why I wanted to have Blake on, because he describes things very well, and he's a really great attorney. I wanted to let him kind of explain to the listeners what the differences are.
I think that's a great idea, Blake.
Well, first of all, thanks for the kind words, Jim. Jim's a great guy to work with, fantastic entity former, and for people that have gun businesses, that's the guy that you would want to go see. Let me start by saying that the Trayvon Martin case and the George Zimmerman, that's a tragic situation. I wasn't on the jury. I didn't sit and listen to the trial, but it really wasn't a stand your ground case. It was a self-defense case. Self-defense basically gives an individual the right, and it's not one statute. Just maybe we should start with that. It's not one statute that's stand your ground and one that's self-defense. There are a number of statutes that incorporate different provisions, one of them being leading the duty to retreat, which is, in effect, stand your ground. But you have to start with self-defense, and self-defense gives you the right to use physical force to protect yourself against somebody else's unlawful use of physical force. That raises to the level of deadly physical force if you reasonably believe that someone is going to either kill you or cause you grave, serious bodily injury.
So when you say reasonably believe, so that becomes a little subjective depending on the mindset of the person maybe under the threat. How difficult is that to prove?
Well, really difficult, and that's why I disagree with many of the commentators, and I think we talked about this a little bit before going on the air. I don't think that the George Zimmerman case emboldened anybody. I think it made them less likely to, A, follow somebody, or B, follow somebody with a firearm, and C, use that firearm, because they saw that George Zimmerman was prosecuted for murder, and anytime you use physical force up to and including deadly physical force, these are defenses to that action. They're not immunities from being prosecuted. They're affirmative defenses that the person using the force has to raise. So what the law says is a reasonable person in the same circumstances as you, under, with the same exigent circumstances, pressure, fear, would they believe that deadly force or physical force was necessary to protect yourself?
And that's under just self-defense by itself.
Just self-defense. Mm-hmm. The only change when you talk about castle doctrine, which is your own house, is that you don't have to consider flight as an option, an alternative option to using deadly force. And that really started by the U.S. Supreme Court in United States versus Beard, which is an 1895 case where there was an individual in his own premises that was the subject of an assault where his life was threatened, and he used deadly force to protect himself. And the court said that when a man is on his own premises, if he comes under attack, he doesn't provoke the assault, and at the time had reasonable grounds to believe and did believe that the individual intended to take his life or do him great bodily harm, in that case, he was not obligated to retreat or consider whether he could safely retreat. That started, in effect, the castle doctrine. You don't have to retreat when you're in your own house. All stand your ground does is extend that to other premises where you're lawfully entitled to be there. You couldn't use stand your ground if you're trespassing, for example. But it really makes it, I mean, the last thing you want to do, I would think, in a situation where you think your life is threatened, is have to decide, can I outrun the guy? Somebody's coming at me with a knife. Do I want to have to say, okay, A, he's going to kill me or seriously injure me. So I'm in my house. I can use deadly force. I'm not in my house. Now, can I outrun him? Now, he's going to try to kill me, but do I have to outrun him? That's all the castle doctrine took away in the situation of your residence, and that's all stand your ground takes away in the circumstances involving somewhere where you're otherwise lawfully entitled to be, like in your car. There's specific statutes in Arizona which say you don't have to flee your car if someone's trying to carjack you. You can use physical force, including deadly force, if you think your life or seriously, if your life's in danger or you are seriously going to be injured. So it's not open season. It's not, you know, someone's in my house, I can shoot them, or someone's trying to steal my car, I can shoot them, or someone looks like they're going to burglarize that house, I can shoot them. You still have the element of, is my life or well-being seriously endangered?
And that makes a lot of sense. So a lot of people are saying, hey, repeal, stand your ground. But it seems like how you described it, which is really nice, like how you described that. I haven't heard it this way before. That there is logic to this, because if you can't outrun a guy or a woman or whoever, whatever the danger is, and your life is threatened, there is that logic why you should be able to protect yourself, you're saying.
Yeah, I don't think we want to put a potential victim in the position of saying, my life's in danger, this person's coming after me, I normally could use deadly force if there's a stand your ground or castle doctrine in my house, but do I have to outrun him first? I think that if someone's attacking you and going to seriously injure or kill you, you shouldn't have to do an extra step, more mental gymnastics to protect yourself.
You know, I was just going to pick up on that, because one of the things I keep thinking about, Blake, is that, you know, these confrontations, you know, they happen so quickly. I mean, all of us sitting around the table here, I mean, we don't go out to the parking lot thinking that somebody's going to come up to us with a tire iron or a gun or something. And all of a sudden, you know, within maybe a second and a half or 2 seconds, you got to make a decision. And if you have a gun, maybe your decision is, I don't know if this guy can catch me or not, or if he's got a gun, maybe I better shoot first. I don't want to get shot in the back. I mean, it's almost like the victim ought to get the benefit of the doubt, and you shouldn't have to, like Blake says, engage in this mental gymnastics of how fast can I run? I used to be able to run, you know, like a 6.5, and now I'm slower, so I can't ride a 10.5. I mean, you ought to be able to say, within like a second and a half or 2 seconds, you may have to make that life or death decision. I don't think you ought to be second guessed on that later on.
So let me ask you, that's a really good point. Generally speaking, from what you've seen, does the victim get the benefit of the doubt before being charged? I mean, is that part of the evaluation by the attorney general or whoever, you know, the prosecutors, for example? Do they give that weight that, hey, someone was in someone's house, for example, and they shouldn't be there, and they had a gun, benefit to the homeowner, right? Or hopefully.
Well, to talk about in the Trayvon Martin case, originally he wasn't charged. That doesn't mean that there's not a report written up. That doesn't mean that the police didn't submit a recommendation for charging, or at least potential charges. What would happen would be somebody breaks into your house, Dave, and you catch them in the middle of trying to haul your plasma TV out. You say, put the TV down, and then they pull a knife out, and they start walking towards you with it, and you defend yourself and use your firearm and you shoot them. What the police would do would be take your statement, any other witnesses' statements. There would be a forensic evaluation of the crime scene to determine, you know, was the guy facing you, was he not facing you, the autopsy, what was the direction that the bullet entered. So the coroner is going to get involved. A lot of things are going to happen, and that's all going to be included in a submission to the county attorney in Arizona. We have county attorneys. They have attorney generals that file these charges, or district attorneys in other states.
Yeah.
All states are different. But a prosecuting attorney is going to then get that and make a charging decision. So it's not the police. It's not you tell the officer when he comes over, hey, this is what happened. Okay, well, put that in the do not charge file. It'll all get written up and submitted to an attorney, a prosecuting attorney, who would make that decision. Hmm. So in the Trayvon Martin case, my understanding is that the original decision was not to charge Mr. Zimmerman. But and you would want a prosecuting attorney to make that decision based upon the evidence. Does he believe beyond a reasonable doubt that this person committed a murder versus defending themselves in a vacuum? He'd hope that that would happen. In the Martin case, there was so much media uproar and so many talking heads on the Alphabet Soup networks that an independent prosecutor was appointed, and then he was charged.
So the
whether
media
or not he should have been charged,
yeah.
I didn't review the,
right.
the report. I didn't review the autopsy report, so I'm not going to comment one way or the other or criticize somebody for charging or not charging that. But even if you're not charged, it's going to be submitted and investigated as if you're going to be charged until somebody makes a decision not to.
Wow. So this is interesting. I'm not going to sway too much off topic, but I bet some of the listeners, their next question, if they were here, would be, is it possible Zimmerman could be charged or have a civil trial for, like O.J. Simpson, right? It's a different standard. He got acquitted, right, for murder. He was just up for parole, by the way.
Yeah.
Did he get out?
I wonder if he got out.
I think
he did
get out. Did he?
Some kind of parole. I'm not sure.
I think it's on ABC, Wide World of Sports now. Anyway, can he be, would that be a civil case for the Martin family?
Well, yes, it would. And in Arizona, you would be able to set up the same defense to a civil action that you would to a criminal action, that I was defending myself, so therefore you don't get to recover. Now, what's interesting in the Martin case, the Zimmerman case, is that the HOA, the Homeowners Association, settled with the Martin family and I believe paid their policy limits of $1 million. And they were the ones who authorized the neighborhood watch for that community.
Really? They already settled this quickly?
Yes.
Wow. Did you know that, Jim? I had no idea.
But it doesn't surprise me. I mean, you know.
Wow, really? They have insurance for that, you think?
Oh, they must have had insurance.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money, isn't it? Oh, my. That's amazing. I had no idea about that. Why don't we take a quick break right now? When we come back, we'll continue this really interesting discussion about stand your ground, self-defense, the Castle Doctrine, and we'll get into other topics related to perhaps gun law. That might be interesting, too. And, of course, this is Breakthrough Thinking and Practical Business Solutions every first Monday of the month. Of each month from 3 to 4, of course, starring Jim Hyten. Our very special in-studio guest is Blake Lightman from Right Now, our Hyten & Lewis great attorneys. We'll be right back.
Money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl.com. www.ireslaw.com.
Welcome back again. You are listening to Breakthrough Thinking live at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. And this is the first Monday of the month, so it is Practical Business Solutions, starring Jim Hyten with special in-studio guest Blake Whiteman from Ragnauer, Hyten & Lewis, both great attorneys. We're talking about Stand Your Ground, the Self-Defense, Castle Doctrine. A question for either one of you right now. The impact on that trial, the Trayvon Martin trial with George Zimmerman, on future situations, do you think there's an unintended result that may have come from this trial?
Well, I don't know that it was unintended or intended, but certainly I think that most people would be less likely to follow someone that they suspected was committing burglaries in the neighborhood, which apparently was Mr. Zimmerman's concern, certainly less likely to carry a firearm and less likely to use the firearm, because Jim and I were talking during the break that the legal expenses in defending yourself are staggering. Now, you can get a court-appointed attorney if you're indigent, but you know, you've got to get over a couple of hurdles to get a court-appointed attorney. And while Zimmerman may have people out there donating to his defense costs, for every George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case there is out there, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of cases where the news media is not involved, where the leaders, civil rights leaders, are not taking a position and pushing it so that there's so much public awareness that there's donations. It's just two fellas or two people that, you know, get into a confrontation, someone ends up getting killed, and it doesn't make the news, so there's not a big fund, and now they've got the whole weight of the county attorney's office on their back, and I don't know that the average person wants to get into that situation. I think that the Zimmerman Martin case really probably chilled more of the use of deadly force or carrying firearms than the other way around, although I think the media would have you believe otherwise.
So that's interesting. Well, I wanted to ask you a question about that. Court-appointed attorney, so that's sort of difficult. So you have to qualify for that, and if you don't, you're on your own?
One of the Miranda warnings that you get, and I'm sure that everybody's seen it hundreds of times on television in various police shows, whether real shows or dramas, is that if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to represent you.
Yeah.
So that's the first hurdle you have to get over to get a court-appointed attorney.
But the key word is if you can't afford, what does that mean then? Afford?
Well, in some courts, they have you fill out a financial statement, and they'll say, well, you can afford an attorney. We're not going to appoint one.
Forward. Really?
Absolutely.
Is it based on income or assets or liquidation?
Oh. Wow.
I mean, you could probably figure that a defense cost would probably take most, if not all, of your savings. You may have to borrow whatever equity you've got in your house. I mean, so I agree with Blake. I mean, for those people who are, you know, involved in these HOAs and neighborhood watch, they're probably all thinking, this is not a good thing to get involved with.
Wow.
I should just, you know, take a description, call 911, let them handle it. And I know in our area, I'm on a very large homeowners board, but that ours is, it's all by internet. Something comes up and people, you know, by internet, you know, send out a description. There are two guys in the neighborhood. They're looking, you know, like they're looking in windows and stuff. We need to be careful. You know, I've called 911. Here's a description. They're not going out there with guns to follow them.
Wow.
You know.
That, you know, so
So if you can't, let's say you can't get a court-appointed attorney, so you can be your own attorney. Is that automatic? You're allowed to represent yourself, or do you have to, or the judge will just not allow it, saying, "Hey, you don't know the procedures." What happens then?
Well, if you could afford an attorney, then your best option is to retain an attorney. It's never to represent yourself. If you can't afford an attorney, the public defenders are good lawyers, but every time they want to retain an expert to do a ballistic analysis or to get a second opinion about the coroner's report, they have to ask the court for permission to expend those funds. And in the Martin case, you had extremely technical forensic evaluation of audio tapes. You know, who was screaming? Was it Trayvon Martin?
Yeah.
Was it George Zimmerman? Yeah. Who was the one screaming?
Yeah.
So if you had a court-appointed attorney and you wanted to do an independent analysis of that tape, that attorney would have to request the funds to do that.
So what I'm trying to figure out is, let's say you earn $100,000 a year, but you virtually have no assets. Your house is upside down, especially the last 5 years. I wonder how they determine affordability. Is it a limit, or do they, you know that type of thing? I mean, how do they weigh it?
Well, ultimately, it's up to the judge. In your hypothetical, you just gave, you earned $100,000 a year, but you had no liquid assets.
Yeah.
If you're charged with burglary, they're going to tell you to go out and retain your own counsel. If you're charged with a DUI, they're going to tell you to retain your own counsel. If you're charged with the Boston bombings, you're probably going to get a court-appointed attorney.
I get you, because one will be a longer,
more expensive.
Yeah, more expensive.
Well, and also, isn't it like that if you're charged with even a felony or a real high crime, that you may well have to actually post bail to get out of jail as well. So you've got an even more expense to do that. So.
Yeah, in serious felony offenses, specifically violent felony offenses, bail is almost prohibitive for most people. You can get a bail bondsman, put up the money sometimes, but you have to pay them 10%. They'll want a deed of trust on your home or something to that effect.
Very tough. The best thing to do is what?
Stay out of trouble. Well, stay out of trouble. And getting back to the homeowner situation, the homeowners association, I don't think it would ever be a good idea for the homeowners association to have members provide any type of security. If a homeowners association believes they need security, and I defer to Jim on this because he's the entity expert in the room, I would recommend as a criminal attorney that they retain a security company to provide, you know, watchmen, those types of things, because then there's a layer of protection. I would never say, "Hey, Joe, you last year you were the treasurer. Do you want to be the security guard this year? We'll get you your CCW permit, your concealed carry permit, and you can just patrol the grounds." That would be, to me, not a good idea under any circumstance.
How about if you're on the board, VP, secretary, president, any liability for board members? Could it extend down if there was something, you know, something in the meeting notes that, hey, we authorize people to go around, you know, armed or whatever? Is that something you got to be careful about?
Well, I'd be careful about it, and I've been on homeowners boards for years, and you know, I just I agree with Blake. I mean, that's what most of the boards I'm on, we encourage people to hire a security firm. And I mean, most of the time, even those people aren't out there with any kind of, they're not armed either. They're cruising the neighborhood. Your typical contract is that they will come through the neighborhood between 2 and 4 a.m. in the morning once, and maybe again, you know, between, you know, 5 and 7 or something. And what they do is they're looking for, they see something, they'll call it in. You know, but they're also not out there with weapons. Most of the time, they're just basically just patrolling.
So it seems like
I guess you got to be a little careful with any involvement. I remember, I think I talked to you, Jim, about this, but I was a VP, and even in a situation where our HOA, the swimming pool, the drain on the bottom, it seemed to be broken. It would suck things down. And I said, as a board member, I think as a VP, I said, close the pool. I don't want a little kid. Right?
Yeah, sure.
And the president overruled me. I think I called you frantic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Remember I said, am I liable for this? And I resigned that day. Because I think that's silly. I mean, think about it. Is that not silly or not, that they would leave the pool open when there's that type of danger? Unbelievable. I know I went off topic, but it points out, if you're a board member, you got to understand what your liability is.
Yeah. Well, again, and whether you're liable or not, you're going to get sued.
Yeah.
Whether the jury thinks at the end of the day that you breached a standard of care is almost irrelevant, because you're going to get sued. So if you've got a private security company, it's an independent contractor, not an employee, you're going to have a layer of protection, and they're going to be the ones that made the decision to use physical force or deadly physical force or to call it into the police or whatever. You're not going to have made that decision, and you're not going to face the or be under the microscope for whether or not the board as a whole was reasonable or unreasonable in having one of its board members act as security, because they knew or should have known that he was had a hot temper or something to that effect. You just avoid all those issues if you hire an independent contractor. They're going to be licensed and bonded, and they're going to have insurance to cover everything. Not to say the board shouldn't have its own insurance, but you certainly wouldn't want one of your board members or an employee performing the task, because it's a straight arrow shot to your liability. Whether you're ultimately found liable or not, you will get sued.
So definitely, I think a good message here is call right now or Heighton Lewis. I mean, I always said it on every show. If you don't have a relationship with an attorney, call them now when you don't need them, so they know who you are, right? I mean,
right. Let
me ask you, as attorneys, if someone just calls you out of the blue versus someone you know, I mean, usually if you know someone already, you know, it's going to be a lot easier if something happens and they need you, isn't it?
Well, my clients have my cell phone number for the most part, have my home phone number, and they know that, and this is the exact wording that I tell them. I'd rather have you call me on a Friday night or a Saturday for a question that I can answer right then and there and alleviate your stress than have you worry about it till Monday morning at 9:00.
I like how you think. That, you know, I'm a former government auditor as a CPA. I tell people the same thing. 24/7, call me. And they go, why would I ever do that? I go, imagine the situation. You come home, it's Saturday, you left Saturday, it's like Sunday morning at 1 in the morning, and you look at your mailbox, you get a letter from the IRS. Instead of worrying all weekend, I usually know what all the letters are about. Give me a call, and then maybe you'll be able to sleep all weekend.
Right.
I mean, doesn't that make sense?
Yeah.
That's really cool, Blake.
Thank you. I'm blessed with clients that don't, you know, abuse it.
Yeah, usually they won't abuse it. Yeah, you're right.
And they know. But I look, if I got a letter from the IRS, I'd be calling you.
Or Jim. Yeah. Hey, Jim's a tax attorney.
Yeah. Either. But I think I have to say, I mean, I think that, you know, we try to kind of infuse that thinking in all our attorneys, because I think clients appreciate that. And I've got a lot of my clients for generations of the family, and so I do the same thing. If you got a worry on the weekend, something comes up, call me. You know, we can probably tell you what's going on so you don't have to worry about it. And, you know, with some of the things that goes on, like in Blake practice, if you're criminal defense law, I mean, that's really stuff that's going to keep you awake at night. So, you know, you want to have somebody who's willing to talk to you and say, here's what it is, here's what you have to worry about, here's what you don't have to worry about.
Yeah. And that makes so much sense. And that's why your firm is it's just no one can touch it in terms of customer service. There's no doubt about it, and sophistication, of course. And you don't see that very often with many professionals, attorneys. You don't see it at all, except I only see it with your firm.
Well, and I don't want anybody to call it to make a decision whether or not they should use deadly force, because if they got enough time to pick up the call,
yeah.
phone and call,
yeah.
they probably are not in that,
that yeah.
dire of a situation.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. So let's go ahead, John.
Go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to mention the Castle Doctrine. You said that is included in many statutes. Is that what you were saying
yeah.
a bit earlier?
For example, the Arizona statute, and it's all in Title 13, specifically 13407, which deals with premises. It basically states that a person can use deadly force to defend their premises if the prerequisites of the justification of use of deadly force for self-defense in general are met. So if you look at that statute, it'll say, if you're in your home, and I'm going to paraphrase, you can threaten deadly force if somebody's burglarizing it. You can't use it, however, under subsection B, unless the requirements of the general deadly force statute is met, which means that you have to believe that you need to use the force to protect yourself from death or serious physical injury. So there's no lower threshold, for example, in your home than there is in general of having to believe that your life or limb, if you will, is in danger.
So that's the key, it sounds like to me. If you think you are in jeopardy or a danger of losing your life or major harm, pretty much in Arizona, is what we're talking about right now, you can use deadly force, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And we can skip to the justification in crime prevention. That's another one. You can use deadly force to stop somebody from committing a first or second degree burglary, manslaughter, child molestation, and a number of other offenses. But again, they have to reasonably believe that it's imminently necessary, meaning it's necessary right now to stop it.
Wow, so it does apply to a whole range of crimes.
And there's an example of a statute that has the stand your ground language in it. When I was saying earlier, it's not in every statute, or it's not in one statute, it's in every statute. There's a new subsection added which says there's no duty to retreat before threatening or using physical force or deadly physical force justified in subsection A. And subsection A is, again, you believe it's reasonably necessary to stop a list of enumerated crimes.
So I bet the general public has no clue about this.
Well, they don't, and even more so, most lawyers don't, unless they practice in criminal law. I would suggest that anybody that is considering buying a firearm at least take the CCW class, and whether or not you decide to carry or not carry is, to me, irrelevant. Take the class, because there's a general legal instruction on when it's okay and when it's not okay. The best short version I can give you is, if somebody's in your house and they're robbing it, draw a line in your mind that if this person crosses that line, I'm going to use deadly force. I'm going to discharge my firearm. And probably the best thing to do would be to pull out your weapon, threaten deadly force, and say, get out of my house now, I'm calling the police. And if they leave, then I don't think it's reasonable to use deadly force. If they start approaching you, you know, and this is taught in the CCW classes, if they get to within a certain distance, then you would use deadly force.
Now, what's CCW stand for?
Concealed carry weapon.
Okay, so that's a good thing to take for anyone that has firearms. And, you know, as you're talking about this is exactly, you know, we have a sports show too. This is what sports teams do. It's called situational, like football, for example. We have Coach Kevin Guy on all the time, every week, Arizona Rattlers. And you think of things that could happen, and you're already prepared. So that's exactly what you're saying. Like, if something happened, you've already rehearsed it in your mind, so you're going to be the most reasonable. You have already rehearsed it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's really a situational awareness, and that's a term used in the military, but it applies throughout life. If you're walking in an area that you know that could be dangerous, then you're going to be on a little higher alert. And this happens automatically. You can train yourself to be better at it, but it happens automatically. If you're in a front yard and you're mowing, and then all of a sudden you see a strange car across the street that you don't recognize, you start to be a little more, wonder what they're there for. Are they visiting Joe, my neighbor? And then they get out and they've got crowbars and gloves on, and you're like, you know, they might be robbing Joe's house. And then as they walk out the front door with television sets, or plasmas or LED.
And they go, hey, buddy, come on over here. You want to buy a TV set?
You probably want to call the police. If they start coming towards you, you know, if you're armed, then you've hopefully prepared yourself for, hey, look, this person is dangerous. I'm going to pull out my weapon because they're committing a burglary, and I'm allowed to threaten to use deadly force. Not use it, but threaten to use it to stop them. To stop it, and if he keeps coming at me and he's still got the crowbar in his hand, there's got to be a line at which you decide I'm going to use the force. And the reason is, and they'll teach you this in a CCW class, is that everything has a reaction time. You learned it in driver's ed in high school. From the time you see something to where you can hit the brakes takes typically a second, and that's why they tell you the two-second rule following, and et cetera, et cetera. Same thing if someone's coming at you with a crowbar. Once they get a certain distance away, you're not able to react and use whatever defensive weapon you have, whether it's pepper spray or a firearm, because you won't be able to react in time before that crowbar splits your head open.
And then it could be worse, because if they get to you and grab your gun, uh-oh, right?
Well, and in fact, what happened in George Zimmerman's case is it appears, because they were in a physical confrontation in direct contact with each other, that he didn't have a mental line in his mind as to when this individual crosses this line. If you could dissect it as an armchair quarterback, I would have, in that situation, said, son, what are you doing in this neighborhood? I'm walking home. Okay, well, why don't you walk on the sidewalk? We've had a lot of burglaries here. Maybe that solves the problem. Maybe it doesn't. Calls 911. They say, leave him alone. Jim said earlier, he probably should have just let him go and let the police come. But if you're going to follow him, now you're – and this is where I think there's a chilling effect. I don't think that people are going to follow people in the neighborhood after the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case. But if you're going to follow him – and then he turns around, he starts coming towards you. In this case, George Zimmerman let it get to a point, and whether he met him halfway or whatever, where they were in a physical contact, because his firearm was discharged when they were in physical contact. Now, one of the forensic experts said that Trayvon Martin was on top because his clothing was not in contact with his skin when the bullet entered him, so he had to be on top leaning over him, whereas if he'd have been on the bottom, his clothing would have been on his skin, and the bullet would have hit the skin and the clothing simultaneously.
That's
so. But again, Joe civilian out there is going, do I want to have to retain forensic experts to prove who was on top or not? Do I want to have to retain audio experts to determine whose voice was whose in this audio recording, all because I decided to follow someone with a firearm? I think the opposite's going to take place. You're not going to have people doing that.
You're probably right. This is a chilling effect.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, you know, Blake just said a lot of great things, you know, in that people should be looking at. But I would say that one of the things that is the most important is that all of this you know, we've seen in the past few months where there's been this huge upswing of people buying firearms. And it's been, you know, Blake and I talk about this all the time. I mean, this is, it's incredible how many people are buying firearms. And I agree with Blake. If you're going to buy a firearm, and a lot of these people are first-time buyers, take the CCW class. Take some instructions so you know what you're doing with that firearm. You just don't take it out there and say, okay, I think I know what I'm doing. I mean, it's probably the second most important thing when you buy the firearms, your first decision. But then the second decision is take the class and learn what you need to know to have a firearm.
And be proficient in using it. Go to the shooting range. Jim and I are both members of different ranges, and I won't mention their names because I don't think they've paid you in any sponsorship fees, but get familiar with it. Yeah, get familiar with it. You know, be able to handle it in a stressful situation, because if you ever have to use it, it's not going to be like you're just getting in a taxi cab relaxed. It's going to be highly stressful. Your field of vision, and there's studies on this, narrows as you get under stress. You start seeing only what's directly in front of you. You lose situational awareness in the sense of you get real focused. So be familiar with that firearm. Don't buy a semi-automatic unless you plan to shoot it once a month. Get a revolver. And if even a revolver, go out and shoot it frequently. Take instruction. Become as qualified to use it as you are your lawnmower.
So that brings up a question, and I totally agree with you. If you haven't been prepared to use it, then you probably shouldn't have it.
Absolutely shouldn't carry it or have it.
Yeah, and what if you legally can have it under the laws, but you don't prepare? You've probably seen people like that. They just, whatever reason is, and something happens, and they pull it out. And they certainly were under threat. They can prove that, but they missed the target and hit an innocent bystander. What happens there?
Well, they're probably not going to be – well, they could be prosecuted criminally for manslaughter, meaning they didn't intend to kill this innocent individual, but they intended to use deadly force. Probably going to be okay criminally. If they were justified in every respect in using deadly force, but they missed and shot somebody else, but I guarantee you they will be sued.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And whether you are negligent in using the firearm civilly is totally different than whether you were justified in using it to protect yourself.
So there's no standard of how proficient you are in using the firearm criminally.
Correct.
But civilly, maybe.
Civilly, definitely.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but, you know, there's also another rule in firearms, and Blake knows, is that, you know, it's the old rule of when you take a firearm out and you aim it at something, you have to understand that anything you're aiming at in that area may be destroyed or killed. And so you need to know what you're aiming at. You need to know what's in the field of fire. You need to know. And, you know, this is no joke. People need to understand it when they're going to defend themselves. There's a lot of consequences that come from this. And I, for one, would not be one of the ones that would want to be in that situation of having to go through that whole process. I mean, if I was, you know, clearly going to be subject to deadly force from somebody or grave bodily harm, yeah, okay, I'm going to do it. But at the same time, you're taking on a lot of responsibility when you pull that gun out.
Yeah, even the hunter education class, which you may not ever intend to carry a defensive firearm, but rule number one, hunter education class, know your target and beyond. Don't shoot at a horizon because the bullet can travel a long way. A pistol is capable of killing somebody a mile away.
Really?
Wow. So yeah. You don't want to shoot it. Same thing with, you know, if you're deer hunting and you see a deer, if it's on a ridge line, don't shoot at it. If you see the horizon behind it, don't shoot at it. Wait till you see ground behind it.
wow, this is so serious. And do you think people, majority of people that buy firearms, because there's a whole bunch of sales these days, it seems like it's gone up. Are they not taking it real seriously, you think?
I think the people that buy a firearm from a firearms-only dealer, for the most part, are encouraged to take classes. The club that I'm a member of has a number of classes, ranging from just basic concealed carry classes to they even have a Ladies of Liberty class for women and women only to take. But if you're going to a big sporting goods retailer, no, they're just selling you the firearm and off you go.
Wow, so you got to take it seriously, no question.
And Mike, this kind of leads into another area we were going to talk about if we had any time, but with the federal firearms license that people have to get to sell firearms at retail, there's nothing in that says that they have to make you go to a class or you have to sign up for a class. All that does is allow them to sell the firearm. There's no corresponding thing they have to make sure you take a class or anything in.
Correct. They can sell you a firearm. If they sell you certain types of firearms, and I'm going to leave machine guns out for now, but if they sell you certain types of firearms, you're only allowed to buy so many within a 30-day period. But they're not required to tell you to seek instruction.
Wow, that's dangerous, isn't it?
Well, it's, you know, if I were to advise any business that sold firearms, whether it was their primary item that they sold or it was a super center type store that sold them along with vacuum cleaners, groceries, and every other thing that they carry, I would tell them that with every firearm sale, they ought to tell the person to take classes, become proficient in it, and have them sign a document that indicates that they were advised to do that. Because, you know, you're not supposed to – one of the things that the BATF has a manual that's only about 300 pages thick, which doesn't include any laws, just gives you just general instruction to someone, a prospective dealer, prospective FFL holder. You can't knowingly sell a firearm to a felon. So you can't knowingly sell a firearm to someone who has a conviction for domestic violence or has a order protection against them or any number of reasons you can't sell it to them. If you do, you're going to get sued if you sell it to somebody, in addition to criminal liability. But do you really want to sell a semi-automatic pistol to grandma who has trouble lifting it up in the store? If grandma, you know, if somebody gets injured, then probably the store is going to get sued. Why not give them instruction, have them sign an acknowledgement that you told them about different places they could take classes to insulate you a little bit from that liability?
I think we've talked about the fact there's so many new stores that are cropping up. They're selling firearms, ammunition, or various things. And I agree with Blake. I mean, even if you sell them a firearm, and even if your store doesn't provide those classes, if it were my store, I would find out where these classes are available. And then I would say, you know, here's a list of them. Would you just sign off on this? I gave you this, and I'm telling you, you ought to go take a class. And like Blake said, I mean, sometimes if they take that class, they'll find out that, you know, they can't lift that gun anywhere close to being reasonable. So they need to – somebody's going to tell them, look, you need to not be using that kind of gun.
Like there's a movie, John Cusack, Gene Hackman, Dustin Hoffman. Craig, remember the name of the movie? Exactly about that, where the manufacturers got sued and they lost as a civil trial.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What was that movie? You remember Gene Hackman, John Cusack?
Yeah, it was
that cute girl.
I remember the movie. I don't remember the name of it, but it was
good
involved.
Movie,
yeah, it was it involved an employee that had a semi-automatic rifle, shot up a bunch of people at work. John Cusack, I think, gets on the jury and he's
manipulation.
Gene Hackman is the jury
consultant
for the. It wasn't Winchester. I mean, they had a funny
runaway
name.
Jury.
Yes.
Or something?
There you go. Yes.
Runaway Jury.
Runaway Jury. Good movie, huh?
It was.
I don't know how realistic, but it's about what we're talking about a little bit, right?
Well, it is in the sense of that's a firearms manufacturer that got sued. More likely that it's going to be a firearms distributor or seller that's going to get sued.
Yeah, right. But still, know the law. No attorneys that can do it, and certainly Blake, you have incredible knowledge in this area. If you're going to hire an attorney, hire someone that knows what they're doing. My theory.
That's why I always say: hire somebody that knows something about it. If you're a store that's doing this, hire somebody like Blake that knows something about an FFL, Federal Firearms License, and kind of understands the area rather than just your family law attorney that really doesn't understand any of that at all.
There's so many specialists these days, and that's what I like about your firm. I think you have about 25 attorneys now, 30?
I don't know. If everybody shows up, how many do we have?
I think we're a couple over, I think we're over 35 now.
Wow, nice. So you got a lot of, and I know most of them. They're great attorneys, and wow, can you believe it? We're out of time. I'd love to do part two of this program.
Be happy to.
Yeah, wouldn't that be good, Jim?
Yeah, it'd be great.
We could do it here, or we could do it remotely at a shooting range or wherever you want to, and I think it'd be great. So, Blake Whiteman, thank you so much for coming in. It's always nice seeing you.
You're welcome, and I'll leave your listeners with this. If we require people to take a parenting class when they get divorced with children, we would at least be having gun stores advise people to take a gun class.
No, there's no question about it. I like that. And so, Jim, thank you, of course. We'll see you next month. But how do people get in touch with both of you?
Well, they can get in touch with me just by calling the main number, 602-254-9900, and ask for me.
And same with you, Blake?
It's the same number, and they can ask for Jim or myself, and our receptionist is very good about directing people to the right attorney.
Is that Carol?
That's Carol.
She's fantastic, the best receptionist in the history of receptionists. Right? I always say that. She knows everyone's name. I call, I don't know how she does it. I call and say, hey, Dave, how's it going? No, it's just amazing. And that's important because that's a tough job. I think it's a tough job to fill.
It is. I think it might be a little bit easier because most of our clients, in fact, I would say almost all of our clients are happy with the attorneys that they're calling to speak with, so it's not as bad. It's when the other side calls, Carol, and they're not represented that she bumps her paycheck.
Right.
I can imagine that. Anyway, thank you both again. We'll see you next month, of course, Practical Business Solutions. This is Breakthrough Thinking Live from the Regis Suites. Tomorrow we'll be on 2 to 4 Breakthrough Networking, and the bottom line, we will talk and have some special guests. We have our Washington correspondent calling in on what's going on with Congress. We'll find out tomorrow. Have a good night.